I think things are going to be permanently changed coming out of this until we get to a vaccine and we can fully vanquish this. We're not going to see a V-shaped recovery or a quick snapback, absent the ability to get a highly effective drug in the hands of doctors that can mitigate the risk, either use as a prophylaxis to prevent infection with people who get exposed to this virus, or treat people who get the virus and are likely at a high risk of a bad outcome. We can have that kind of drug by the summer and certainly by the fall. I don't see the kind of deliberate industrial approach, all hands on deck approach to trying to get that kind of therapeutic. And there are things that are promising right now that could be brought forward more quickly. But absent that, this is going to be an 80% economy. There are things that are not coming back. People are not going to crowd into conferences. Yeah. They're not going to crowd into arenas. The marginal customer is not going back to movie theaters and cruises and Disneyland. And we need to accept that.
That was former FDA Chief Scott Gottlieb on Face the Nation Sunday. Hello, everyone. Happy, hopefully near the apex Monday to you all, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined virtually, and this time only on audio, by my colleagues Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi, gang.
Well, it's Monday.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
A quick note to listeners up at the top. For those of you who did consume this roundtable last week via visual media, send us a note. What did you think? What would you like to see? More origami, whatever. Just tell us how it is, because we're going to probably experiment with that in future episodes. All right. So let's do a quick update on where we're at with the Rona as of April 6th. President Trump has said that this is going to be our toughest week so far. The death toll in the U.S. is nearing, or maybe has crossed, 10,000. The peak is expected for around 11 days from now. There's been 70,000 deaths worldwide, although at least a half a dozen hard-hit countries have turned the corner and are starting to go downward on their curve. More than 90% of Americans, I think, now are living under some kind of stay-at-home order, including the four of us. The weekly unemployment claims last week doubled the previous ginormous record of the week before, well over 6 million Americans claiming unemployment. Huge hit to the economy. Congress has been making noises about some kind of phase four, which is even worse than the Boston record from 1987, about a stimulus, rescue, bailout, whatever. Thank you, Nick.
Don't look back, Matt. Don't look back.
And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was hospitalized over the weekend after having tested positive 10 days ago. And everyone, for some reason, last night and even this morning, were passing around, sharing on social media, a video message from 175-year-old Queen Elizabeth telling everyone to buck up and keep a stiff upper lip. We did our first corona-related podcast here, I think, March 2nd, which was about 15 or 16 lifetimes ago. Most of us have been on quarantine for 3 or 4 weeks since then. But before we get into sort of the weeds of policy and discuss the usual outrages, I wanted to kind of do a gut check, or a cup check, as we used to do, Nick, as you well know.
Oh, yeah.
Of all of us.
At least two of my former soccer coaches became former soccer coaches because they kept asking for cup checks in inappropriate moments.
Every moment was inappropriate. But anyways, I wanted to get what we have ourselves learned personally about ourselves during this time of quarantine, which is a unique experience for sure. So let's start with Peter. And again, Peter, it can't be that you love video games and measuring cocktails precisely. What have you learned about yourself that you didn't quite know, you know, 3-4 weeks ago or a month ago?
I learned just how much I love playing video games and measuring cocktails precisely. So,
no.
You know, I was thinking about the the time frame here and just how fast all of this has moved, and your kind of reference back to the podcast from 1 month ago from March 2nd. So that was right before Super Tuesday. That was in that weird 4-day stretch where we all went from, or at least where I and quite a few other people named Nate Silver went from thinking that Bernie Sanders was absolutely going to win the Democratic nomination to thinking, wait a minute, actually, he's really not. And Joe Biden's going to win the nomination. That particular day, I was thinking, mostly about the Democratic presidential nomination and maybe about, like, am I going to have to buy? I think that was the week that I bought toilet paper. It stocked up a little bit there. And I was having discussions with my wife, who was on the campaign trail, about whether or not we were going to stock up on groceries. She got home later in that week. And it was later in that week where I really realized that it was going to be a shit show. And the moment, I think I can actually trace it to a specific moment, which was on March 6th. That's a Friday. So that was actually a couple of days after this podcast, the first one where we talked about this seriously. And it was when South by Southwest was canceled. And that was before the big sports leagues started saying we're not going to be playing. That was before some of the other major conferences and events. And South by Southwest is tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars worth of conference. It is the mega conference of all mega conferences. And it was that moment when I looked and said and sort of realized, oh, my goodness, someone has decided that this is so important, or some small group of people have decided that this is so important that they are going to cost themselves and all the people they work with certainly well into the tens of millions of dollars and probably hundreds of millions of dollars. And they're going to set a precedent that other conferences are at least going to have to consider, that other sports leagues, that other major gatherings are going to have to consider. That was also the day that I started hearing from folks in New York at big financial firms that were saying, look, we're basically going to shut down our offices, that sort of thing. And so it was in that week between March 2nd and March 9th, between those two podcasts, where I started to realize this is going to be a very big deal. And I think that if I, you know, going back to what I was saying on March 2nd, I thought that it was going to be a deal. I thought that people were going to overreact. I thought there was going to be some sort of political panic, but I didn't really realize how it was going to reshape life. And it was, you know, if you go back to the March 9th podcast, that was the one where I talked about I had already bulk purchased food and stocked up, and I was preparing for a time of shutdown. And I think at least a few other people on this podcast on that episode on March 9th thought that I was a little bit crazy.
Still think you are crazy, Peter DeBichon.
But for different reasons, not because I have 25 pounds of flour sitting in my utility
room.
That's
valuable these days. People are stress baking, and there's a run on flour. I remember...
Oh my goodness, the sourdough bread in my house that is coming out fresh every Sunday is so good.
Thankfully, I've got a mute on my Twitter for people's sourdough bread tales, so like it cuts the thing by a third. I recall, but you mentioning South by Southwest, Peter, that I went on Kennedy's program on, I believe, March 10th, and we talked about coronavirus and her thing. It's like, yeah, you know, that seems a little bit too extreme, canceling South by Southwest. And like, that's a different lifetime ago. And Kennedy herself had to go in quarantine for a while, but she's out of it, thankfully, today. Nick, what have you learned about yourself, just that you love too much?
Sure. I've learned that. And I've also learned, excuse me, many of the people in life are inessential. You know, we're talking a lot about essential and non-essential workers and stuff. And like, I'm tighter than ever with my family and with relatives and friends. And, you know, the other stuff, like a lot of things in life, are less pressing, including politics. This has been a centering experience for me. And I've learned that, it's important to maintain love and work, I guess, is, you know, what Freud talked about. And, you asked what I learned about myself. That's what I learned. One of the things that I hope that comes out of this on a bigger level is a kind of societal-wide kind of understanding of what does work mean, and, you know, not a work-life balance, but rather where does work end and life begin? And I have been living a version of this quarantine for almost the past 25 years, because I've worked mostly remotely and mostly from home with reason. I think, you know, that's becoming more common. And it's a good thing, but there's real costs to it as well. And I think we'll need to have an ongoing kind of experiment in how people deal with all that.
Catherine, you're an unfeeling robot from the future. Can you talk about your feelings and what you have learned during this time?
As always, yes, I am delighted to talk about feelings. You know how I love that.
You're the Dolores. You're the Dolores.
We'll get
reason,
back.
Aren't you? in
we'll
Westworld?
We'll get back to some of these questions at the end of the
Dolores
podcast.
Dolores is definitely, ripped off your fashion sense this season. I just want to say, you got there first, and Dolores was just like...
that's right.
Catherine Mangu Ward.
She's biting my style. Biting
always
my style.
Wearing the pumps.
The thing that I have learned is that I am definitely... maybe too much of an anti-catastrophizer, but also that's not going to change. So basically, like, it's true. If I went back and listened to those two pods that Peter referenced, the ones from the beginning of March, and I'm like, haha, you crazy people are freaking out. It's going to be fine. And I'm struck by the fact that both the crazy people were right to freak out, but also that it is fine. In my personal narrow life, like, it is not fine in the world and the economy and on a bunch of different levels, but I didn't do any preparation, basically. And I am more or less in exactly the same position as, say, Peter Suderman, who did a bunch of preparation. I am more or less in exactly the same position as people who did much less preparation than I did. And that, so far, is resting entirely on the fact that a lot of our important systems really haven't broken down. Even though things feel messed up, we don't actually have real shortage. I mean, we're joking about the flour shortage, right? But, like, we don't have a real shortage of edible staple goods.
We don't even have a shortage of flour. What we have is a supply chain mismatch.
A slight misallocation of flour in different geographical locations and a slight mismatch of labor to bring it to the right locations. But I think that I have been benefited across my life by being a non-catastrophizer. Like, if you don't prepare for all the emergencies and then some of the emergencies don't happen, you can come out ahead. But then if there is one bad emergency that's really, really bad, am I going to get screwed more than other people? And this feels like a good test of that principle. And so far, I don't seem to be screwed more than other people. Again, my baseline was really high. I was already one of the best off people in the world. So that helps a lot. But I didn't panic. I'm still not panicked. I'm probably never going to panic, even maybe eventually when panic is warranted.
I realize that people can't see Catherine's background, but she's talking from the recent office. I was expecting a sheet of flames to go up behind you. And it's like, no, everything's
fine. I'm drinking coffee, too.
Don't you feel vindicated right now? Yeah. Yeah. Don't you feel vindicated?
No, I mean, I don't feel vindicated. I made a bunch of predictions.
I don't mean vindicated is wrong.
Like, I was wrong about the actual facts on the ground. I made predictions that were incorrect. I just think I have discovered an interesting gap between, like, I can be wrong about the scale of the thing and still kind of have it not affect my personal life so far in a way that reinforces the behavior for me personally.
I already knew that I wasn't a millennial and that I was an anti-millennial, just in terms of my basic orientation. But I learned how much so in terms of communication devices, right? Because people need to be in touch a lot more. Like, my 5-year-old upstairs is on her Zoom meeting number 3, I think she's already done this morning. So there's, like, this constant stream of telecommunications. My phone is buzzing off the hook, and I can't stand it.
Your world moves to digital. Matt Welsh hardest hit.
No, just like the constant, like, little jolts of, like, and pokes and things like that. I've got to reset my things so that
I hate to say it, you do realize you can change your notifications, Matt.
Yeah, and I have. But there's still some that
even on your jitterbug phone.
My jitterbug phone.
What people who are listening can't see is that Matt Welsh is making all of these gestures that suggest that there are notifications kind of, like, floating around him in, like, fireworks style.
They are.
Yeah. It's like a beautiful mind for Matt Welsh.
I'm looking for weapons in the
He's an episode of
baseball
Sherlock power, so. Over here. I of course am experiencing.
Yeah, think of Matt's memory palace.
Oh my
palace.
God, Matt's mind palace is just like a garage with a stack of records in it. I of course am experiencing exactly the opposite.
Bin with old baseballs.
Even though I also do not identify as a millennial because I am not one, I am really experiencing the opposite. On Saturday, I attended a surprise birthday party. Here's how I did it. I put on red lipstick and I held up my phone in front of my face, and we all got on some app that I hadn't heard of an hour before and went, surprise, for a friend's birthday. And then we were done. And I was like, this is the surprise party I've always wanted to attend.
Yeah, very little cleanup.
I just took the lipstick back off again when I was done.
Yeah. As long as we're, Matt, you brought up generational hatred. And as yes. the token baby boomer on this, and you know, right. the coronavirus in some places is being called the boomer remover. And this really, you know, I realize you asked, like, what new did you learn? One of the things that this is really underscoring even, you know, more and more for me, in all caps, italics, underscore, is, man, the baby boom generation just won't fucking go away. You know, somehow at the exact moment that they're being pushed off the stage by just eventual old age and cultural irrelevance, you know, a virus comes that only targets old people, and somehow it's still going to be like an 800-year-old man running the government next year, no matter who ends up winning. And somehow, like, we're giving, you know, of that $2 trillion, you know, like 5 cents of it is going to individuals. A lot of it's going to corporations. All of it is going to end up in baby boomer pockets. Like, this has somehow extended their purchase on American political, cultural, and economic life another 20 years, and it's appalling.
Just so we're clear, are you coming out as objectively pro-generational side now?
Well, I have committed in print to being the Quisling of my generation. There's nothing I want to do than collaborate with even the sad sack Gen X people, Matt, like yourself. We just got to, whatever, we have to amenitize the eschaton, get rid of the baby boom, and whatever comes will have to be better.
Let's talk a broader picture, intersecting more with policy and culture, I suppose. Of what other stuff that this crisis and the response to it and kind of the unfolding whatever has taught us about our own systems, whether health systems, political systems, and whatever else. Suderman, I'm going to start with you. What
circulatory respiratory systems?
The national respiratory systems. What has this taught us about our national lungs, Peter?
I don't know if you guys saw, but there was a paper that was making the rounds on Twitter that basically suggested that you could disinfect yes. your upper respiratory system by more or less huffing the vapor from a whiskey hot toddy. And that in the same way that you can can kill the coronavirus on your hands using soap or using a hand sanitizer, which is made, of course, with alcohol, you could kill little droplets of it in your upper respiratory system by basically turning your the upper part of your breathing apparatus into a bodily still. And so you add super hot water to the whiskey, and then you like stuff your nose into an insulated coffee mug for like 2 minutes, and then it just sort of wafts up into your nose and your mouth and coats the inside of it, and it turns your whole, but right. And like, if you think about it, like the shape of your respiratory tract is pretty much the shape of a still for distilling liquor. Right. And so it's the same idea. And so you're just trying to coat it with whiskey. And I've learned that I think that is awesome, and I'm going to make that my life plan here. I'm going to, you know how you're, like how washing your hands 10 times a day is supposed to, it's like it reduces your chance of getting infected by like 55% or something like that. And it's actually pretty much the most effective thing that you can do. This is like washing your hands, but for your upper respiratory tract. And so I'm going to have to do this like 10 times a day.
Matt, you're big on hot toddy Twitter, aren't you?
I'm more like Paloma Becarovka drink Twitter, trash fam Twitter. Here, Catherine, try to answer the question that Suderman just dodged.
Sure. I'm here for you.
As he's coating his lungs with his
Wild Turkey 101
cocktails.
Or higher for proof, folks. You got to use
loud.
The high proof stuff.
So,
what have we learned about?
Wow. Holy moly.
What have we learned besides recipes, Catherine?
So one thing that I have learned is, so I have sort of often joked that a lot of my life is set up to avoid interpersonal obligation. So just as a absolutely horrible rich white lady example of this, I get my house cleaned by people who I hire on an app, and I don't talk to them and I don't see them and I don't have a personal relationship with them. Many people who are rich white people like me, who are the plague on our society and kill all billionaires or whatever, they have like a lady that comes to their house that they know, who's a person that they know. And the difference in how my way versus that way has played out on a whole bunch of levels, like people that we have commercial relationships with that we also have personal relationships with, and how those relationships affect our lives. I have been extremely happy to not have to think about all the people I have commercial relationships with as people for the most part, but I have been interested to watch people around me think a lot about that, to have like really deep thoughts and feelings and kind of complicated relationship calculations about what they owe to the people they buy things from. And this is also, you know, in DC in particular, I think there's this huge thing about like you had to get takeout from your local restaurants to keep them alive. When you get your groceries delivered, you know, if you get them delivered from a local place versus from Peapod, like how do you do the tipping with that? What is our relationship to the quote unquote essential workers who are not really, really, really essential, like the people who work at Starbucks, but who are still going to work every day? And I have found myself, as I say, both like relieved to not have to do a ton of those calculations, but fascinated by the ways in which other people are doing them really sincerely. And I think it's a good example of how commercial relationships, which are sometimes derided by people on the left as like wage slavery or servitude or impersonal or alienating by people on the right, they're actually all real relationships, and people think and feel deeply about them. And even the few that I have, the few human relationships I maintain outside of my immediate circle, I feel like I've done the same. And I'm like inspired by that, I guess.
My late friend, Kathy Sipe, who was friends with Nick as well, died more than 10 years ago. But when she got the cancer that ended up killing her, she, I think, even wore a shirt, but her motto was, "Cancer has not made me a better person." So I think
has not made me a better person.
Catherine,
it's true.
Has not made you a better person. That comes to mind because I am the person that you're talking about in terms of, oh, let's make sure that we, or, you know, my wife and I, let's make sure that we patronize the local Greek restaurant around the corner and you know, thank them for what they're doing. That like the market is an ecosystem. Our neighborhood is an ecosystem. We want to nurture it. I am incredibly thankful of everyone that I transact with. And I mean, the sort of the knit calculation, what's the most valuable, which bodega means the most to me, you know, there, and which ones don't. But I think those ecosystems are, we're going to miss them when they go. And some of them are going to go as part of this, like many of them. And that makes me really sad. Nick, maybe you'll answer my question. What have we learned about the country? You had a post just this morning about how government screwed up coronavirus response. This is a stress test. For sure, of the way that we handle our governance and a lot of other things here in this country. What has the stress test revealed about how we work?
I think I was watching something about the Cold War, and I was reminded of, you hear this a lot from people in countries, say, you know, Iraq or the Middle East or parts of Latin America, Eastern Europe, where I guess it's a little bit different there, but people will say, you know, I love America, but like, I'm not such a big fan of a government that, you know, sent Marines in to kill a popularly elected, you know, leader and install a coup, you know, and then trained a secret police to torture us for the next 50 years. I think something like that is being revealed here in America is that when you look around and when you see the way that most people, most businesses, and most nonprofits are responding to all of this, and most workers in the government, not the people who are calling the shots, but the actual people out in the field, like, it's really you know, powerfully moving to see the way that people are responding to this, and they're being charitable, they're being social, they're being good, they're being, you know, just this is a country with enormous good faith. And then you look at, you know, the reveal of when you see people like Jared Kushner talking you know, last Thursday in a press conference. And it's like, what the fuck? When you look at, you know, Donald Trump and you know, I think, you know, among the people certainly on this podcast and a lot of people at Reason, I'm not, you know, I don't think Trump is particularly worse than Obama or George Bush. He has not been good in this. He's not the cause of things, but he's not been good. His administration has not been good in responding to a lot of this. And what's really important is that it's not, you know, it's not Trump appointees at the CDC and the FDA who were screwing things up. It was, you know, bureaucrats, et cetera. And I think what is being revealed here, Matt, partly is the gulf between the official apparatus of power, of government power at all different levels. You know, what is it, Vermont, where people, you know, they're closing off the toy aisle in Walmart because that's not essential shit to buy. It's like, what the fuck is wrong with these people? And they are not the people that you're bumping into or walking, making sure you don't bump into on the street. They're not the people who are keeping the lights on at Walmart. They're not the people making sandwiches at Subway. You know, and that to me, it makes me feel good because in the end, there's more of us than there are of these idiot bureaucrats who are so flat-footed, deer in the headlights, you know, name your metaphor, who just, you know, are like, you know, they remind me, we did a video years ago of a museum in LA that documents East Germany. And the curator of that was talking about how when the Berlin Wall collapsed, when it was pulled down and people started moving freely between East and West Berlin, there were guards who showed up for like a week afterwards trying to take down everybody's number and name and like continued doing things as if the Berlin Wall had not just collapsed. And I think we see that in many of the kind of actions of government. And it's appalling, but it's more than counterbalanced by the overwhelming, you know, goodness of how other people are acting, including many of the people in government.
I would add amplify. It seems to me that this crisis has shown kind of again that our political culture is not geared to suddenly, you know, snap its head back to attention due to external crisis. Our political culture is sick, I think. And I'm talking not just about government here. I'm talking about people who are very online, who are very engaged in culture. I'm talking about the media that covers politics and covers on a daily basis the kind of theatrics of this much more than the actual policy, or the ones who do. I'm not saying that all of them do, but yeah, that there's an element of that, and including the element of the media doesn't have a great track record in covering, you know, new study proves it type of journalism. There's a tangible sense of relief that comes every time you can feel it on Twitter and elsewhere, whenever there's an obvious enemy here, whenever there's an obvious like, oh, look, the bad guy on the other team did the bad thing. People want that. People are hate watching the White House daily briefing. It's like, you could turn it off. You know, you don't like that.
I recommend that.
I do too. Like, it's very rare. I watch the LoveGov every day, and even that is just because I live in New York and I want to know what an update is on the hospital situation here, because, you know, it's pretty bad. The morgues are kind of piling up around us, and even Cuomo, he gets his brother on and they start like jackassing back and forth. And I get it's kind of comic relief, and that's interesting. But our political culture is not ready. It's we still have a lot more sinking left to do, and I don't think it's going to be fixed anytime soon. I don't think there is any wake up call. People have become.
There's no vaccine for that.
Too soon.
There's it's not even being developed.
People have become addicted to the stupidities in politics, and that goes for people who are political office. That goes for people who kiss the president's ass.
That
you know,
is not
every
socially
single press
distancing.
Conference. It's just really.
Just to be clear,
it's
no. can we actually just take a quick break and discuss the Cuomo brothers situation? Have we done that on this podcast yet?
No,
what
you go for it.
Happening with that? Like, I am not okay with it. I get why people like it. I get it's cute. They're brothers. They're, you know, waka waka. But like, It's such a perfect little distillation of the disgusting interconnectedness between a certain aspect of the media and politics. It's the nepotism, the like family business of holding and wielding power, the gross.
Yeah, like move to England, you know, if you want to have a dynasty, like, get the hell out.
I really am struggling with the fact, like, does no one remember that the Cuomos are bad? Like all of them? They're bad. Like, okay, I get it that we're looking for heroes just as much as we're looking for villains. And I think that part of it is just as poisonous. Like, everyone's out there looking for the like, bad guy and hate watching Donald Trump or whatever. But also, people are erasing the multitude of sins of the entire Cuomo dynasty, including the fact that it is a dynasty. And it makes me want to vomit.
The other thing that it's obscuring somewhat, and I agree completely, Catherine, is, you know, that Mario Cuomo, and Matt, I'm sure you have fever dreams of him every night. I do, you know, just like Chris Cuomo, that he's still in office, but he presided, he was a three-term governor of New York and helped destroy New York State at a time when things could have changed. He did nothing to help the state because he was too enamored of his stupid, you know, like Depression era immigrant stories about what to do to help a once the largest, most populous, most economically forward state in the country, which was sliding into irrelevance. And Andrew Cuomo actually is doing the same thing as governor. He came into office hitting every right note. He was going to cut taxes. He was going to cut business regulations. He was going to seriously look at fracking for Western and upstate New York. And within, you know, 6 months, he had his ass kicked by all of the existing interests and now presides over a state which, thank God, it has New York City in it, because without that, it's a long, slow mess. Really appalling.
This is, I think I've mentioned on this podcast before that my husband is very, very slowly reading the Robert Caro LBJ books.
Is there a way to read it quickly?
Like house.
I mean, it's.
Well, it's like he's reading them especially.
Each one
slowly,
of them is the length of all the Game
like
of Thrones
10,000. That's correct. They're like 10,000 pages.
But you know, you don't want to get ahead of the. I mean, like it'll suck to wait 10 years for the next volume.
Yeah,
to
no,
come out,
he's
so
he's
well
coming to
it
the.
Slow.
It's true. He's coming to the end of the existing oeuvre, which is upsetting to him. But like a bingo game that we're playing in our house is just like last names in these books that are the names of all the people who are still in politics, and it's disgusting. Just over and over, he's like, "Oh, Romney, drink." You know what I mean? It's like they're just. These books are about a totally bygone era, like a lost time, even more so than, say, February. And it's the same jokers or their nephews still in charge.
Ed, to kind of maybe finish the thought that I meant to make earlier, the gulf between all of that and the gulf even between people who pay a lot of attention to politics, that includes us, and other people that you encounter during this process, your neighbors, people in the street, people you buy stuff from, couldn't be more vast, it seems to me. And there's some lesson there. Don't know exactly what it is, but we're thinking about. Let's talk a little bit about things that are happening that are still newsworthy, but that are not gaining attention in the current moment, because life does move on, governance moves on, other things move on, and it's our job as kind of slightly askew from the mainstream human beings as we are to point some of these things out. So, Sudarman, why don't you go first? What is a thing that's happened in the world that isn't coronavirus that you think nonetheless listeners to the Reason Roundtable might be or should be interested in?
I would just point to an essay in The Atlantic by Adrian Vermeule, I think it is, of Harvard Law School, titled Beyond Originalism, in which he argues that originalism as a mode of constitutional interpretation has kind of outlived its usefulness, because apparently we only needed it to produce outcomes that Christian authoritarians like him wanted. And it's just an argument for a complete abdication of procedural liberalism, of the idea that the law should treat everyone fairly and that it should not be outcome-based but process-based. It is It completely gives the game away. Not that it's exactly surprising, but it completely gives the game away in the sense that there is a contingent of conservative thinkers out there who really don't care for fairness and for consistency in legal matters, right? That they don't think that that groups should be treated equally under the law. They think that the law is a tool that should be wielded by the powerful in order to achieve their preferred social ends. And the thing that really stuck out at me, and Matt, you wrote a very good piece about this and about sort of how revealing it was about their sort of a certain mode of conservative thinking and of philosophizing. But the thing that actually really struck me, especially after the Tsuruba-Mari wars of last year, was how much of this is sort of cloaked as we want a good society. We want a moral world. We want a place that's safe for children and families. But it's just about aesthetic preferences. It is entirely about, I think that what you want, the way you want to live your life, the stuff you want to watch online, the thoughts you want to think, the words you want to say, I think they're icky and I don't like them. And I think that is in fact, if not one of, maybe even the chief job of government, is to stop you from thinking icky thoughts, saying icky things, doing stuff that I find just sort of gross. And just how incredibly shallow and thin it all is. There's just nothing to it beyond a kind of like aesthetic preference for a very particular way of living and a sort of sense that lurks behind it all. You know, like a lot of us find ourselves. The way we achieve happiness is by doing something we like, but there's a certain type of person, and I think Vermeule is one of those people who isn't happy unless he's forcing other people to do things they don't like. That is his source of personal pleasure, and that's what this is all about.
So he's Ilse She-Wolf of the SS.
Yeah, the one oddity about it all, I appreciate the effort because, like, yeah, please get it in writing. I want to hear what your end game is, and it's an authoritarian essay is really the best way to think about it. But it's also like that's never going to be popular, right? Like it's been manifesto season for a long time among the integralist crowd. All these recent converts, and Vermeule's another one. Tsuruba-Mari is another one. Gosh, save us from the new Catholics. But it's like this is not ever going to be a close to majoritarian thing in American politics. I recommend people read Randy Barnett's repost over at the Vault Conspiracy about this. Randy, obviously an originalist kind of hero, and he gives it kind of the measure that it deserves, which is like, yes, it's sort of alarming, it's also kind of amusing, and there are interesting overlaps. I tried to get into my post here of like there are common thoughts on the mainstream kind of left professorate out there that also believes that we should aggrandize power in the executive branch and wield it for the common good. They just dress it up in different ways, and it's revealing. And we should be responding to both actual power grabs and intellectual desires for such by looking around us and say, okay, are we, even while, you know, responding negatively to that, are we looking around and volunteering to give government more authority? And like reading people's response to this, my God, this is fascist. This is terrible. Okay, Trump, can you declare a national emergency lockdown now? What's wrong with you?
Make respirator masks at home under the Defense Production Act, please, Mr. President, you authoritarian bastard.
Yeah.
Or else I'll vote against you.
That is the thread between these two things. Like everything is in the end still about coronavirus, and like the kind of Vermeulean, first thingsian common good conservatism or whatever it is we're calling it. Like it's just a weird subvariation or a retread of the Mencken line about Puritanism, right? It's just like the haunting fear that someone somewhere is having a good time or is happy or whatever it is. Like that's certainly what so much of it reads like to me.
I think that it needs, Matt, you were kind of pushing in this direction too. This, you know, what we need to do, I think, as libertarians in particular, is take this open reveal, and it's also trotting around in books like Ross Douthat's, you know, The Decadent Society or whatever. It's like, oh yeah, you know what? Like right now when I'm sitting in a fucking lockdown in New York City, the real problem is online porn. That's destroyed America. And like we have to throw all of our might against online porn and people making consumer choices that I don't find, you know, worthy of indulgence. We have to draw a line between that type of thinking, and the right has been naked in its willingness to say, no, we really do want to control every aspect of your lives, particularly your personal lives, in the you know, greater glory of the good America. But we need to yoke that to the resurgence on the left of like things like the Green New Deal, which is every bit as much aesthetic. It isn't about making the air cleaner or the water better. It's about saying, you know, because if it was, then it wouldn't be like, oh, well, you have to pay workers this amount. You can't do this, but you can do that, et cetera. It's all about control. What I've been thinking about a lot over the past couple of weeks here is we ran a great story by Chuck Freund back in the day after Kabul was liberated. And he talked about how what people did when the Taliban was booted from power was that, you know, they didn't go and say like they didn't go to long church services. They went and they dug up the TVs and the VCRs in their backyards that they had buried because they were illegal under the Taliban. The men went and got Leonardo DiCaprio and Beatle haircuts, which were also banned under the Taliban. The women went to nail salons and makeup beauty parlors and things like that. Hopefully we come out of this, you know, with something like that, where we recognize the things that we want to be able to do, to be free to do on a day-to-day basis without having an answer to anybody. These are not bad things. We shouldn't be ashamed of wanting a particular kind of sandwich or going to the toy aisle in Walmart or anything like that. That is the stuff of individualism, of freedom, of capitalism, of liberalism properly understood. And these people, whether they're on the right or the left, who are saying, no, 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 you have to live my way or the highway. It's like, look, you know, get the fuck out. You know, like this isn't your country because, Matt, you're right. It's very unpopular what the right is selling right now. And so it is with the left.
Catherine, do you have an entrance in the stuff that you should be paying attention to, but you're not because of the coronavirus?
I do have an entrant, and it is Joe Biden sexually assaulted someone, maybe. Should we talk about that? That seems...
You're the lady.
Yeah, it seems like this is the kind of story that in any other moment would be utterly consuming our news cycle and maybe even should be by right. You know, Robbie Suave at Reason has plausibly, to me, made the case that these allegations are at the very least both more serious and somewhat more likely to be subject to kind of proof or useful discussion than the allegations against Brett Kavanaugh during his confirmation hearing. The woman's name is Tara Reid, and she says that Joe Biden sexually assaulted her while he was in office. This is not, a forgotten, a half-remembered, confusingly narrated transgression from a long time ago. Even those transgressions are worth considering. But I have been truly amazed at the extent to which all discussion of that allegation has been shut out. At the time that Robbie wrote his original piece, at least, I'm not sure if this is still true, the Washington Post had not even mentioned the existence of these allegations. So it just seems to me like I didn't enjoy it when our national conversation was consumed with litigating the sexual guilt or innocence of powerful or potentially powerful men to the point of just like full-time culture war. At the same time, the imbalance in how this one is being treated compared to others strikes me as its own miscarriage of justice.
I think the three men here are being agreeably silent. That's good.
Just to put it out there, haven't we, you know, when you think about, okay, so Brett Kavanaugh got a full hearing, he's on the Supreme Court, you know, Donald Trump, you know, he's president, Bill Clinton, you know, rode out his second term and, you know, he was impeached, but he ended with a really high approval rating and has spent the past 25 years or whatever it is, 20 years gallivanting around the globe, being everybody's, you know, everybody's.
And smart. Arnold Schwarzenegger's petting donkeys.
Yeah. It's a weird thing. I mean,
in his dining room.
I do think, Catherine,
that's not a metaphor or anything.
You know, as long as he's not having unacknowledged children with them, I think we can give him a pass on the donkey problem. But I suspect that this story will come back into fuller view when we start talking about politics again, because one of the weird moments.
But it'll be too late,
The nomination. No, because the nomination wasn't going to hinge on this. But I don't think the nomination, it'll be in the general election. I think it'll be something of an issue. But, you know, then again, this is where Republicans said, you know, religious conservatives and all of the people who supported Trump said, I don't care if he sexually assaulted women, which is essentially what they said. They said that with Roy Moore, et cetera. So it's going to be hard to, you know, to have this conversation.
But that's not going to stop.
Does petting donkeys make him an ass patter?
No. If it tries to run away and he tries to catch it, I think it's an ass grab.
I will. I make very few predictions, political predictions, but I will predict this. If Joe Biden, you know, survives the coronavirus and becomes the Democratic nominee, there will be, and if there is a debate, and I don't know if that's going to ever happen, but if there is one, you can bet that Donald Trump is going to try to bring Tara Reid in the front row.
Oh, yeah. Tara Reid will be sitting on his lap.
Absolutely.
Tara Reid is going to Zoom bomb the debate.
Yes. A lot of Zoom bombing. Before we get into what are you consuming, Nick, do you have any other entrants of stuff that we should be paying attention to that are not because of the Rona?
I mean, one of the things that is, I think has changed, and again, a lot of this stuff may come back once we're through this and people are like, okay, we've got to go back to our old habits. A lot of tech policy, which was, you know, really angry and really focused on the need for social media to restrict what people are able to see, particularly in terms of political ads and things like that. Most of that conversation has totally disappeared. Nobody talks about net neutrality anymore, which is a nice thing. And one of the things that has, you know, the internet has been one of the great, you know, kind of fallbacks of everything that we're talking about. You know, when Catherine is saying, like, you know, we're doing pretty well, it's mostly because of the internet. I mean, it's unfathomable to think what would this be like without the internet, you know, and the internet and social media and things like it is now, not even like the internet circa 2000. And I think that questions about tech policy, particularly about content regulation of speech, particularly political speech, which was very big deal before coronavirus. I mean, as you know, that has faded, and I worry that that is kind of lurking in the shadows to come back.
I should just mention that as we were sitting here, Peter mentioned Zoom bomb. We came within about an eyelash of getting a 5-year-old bombed on this podcast. She's discovered.
Matt, now I hate to say it, but you're acting like you're in the Cuomos or something.
Oh, as long as he doesn't, as long as, like, here, you know, his daughters aren't taking political office right now, I think we're okay.
Yeah, okay. It's not going to happen. Okay. She's discovered that it's very funny whenever daddy has headphones on and is talking to the computer to come with mallets and hit me on the ears, which is pretty exciting. All right, let's go to what we have been consuming. I will go first. Why not? Sorry, I'm already laughing with my...
You're laughing at your own joke that you haven't told yet?
I'm not. No, I'm laughing at the jokes that Norm MacDonald has been telling on his quarantine video cast, which is just super lo-fi. He literally turns on a camera. I'm just gonna call my friend here and, like, calls Roseanne, calls Chevy Chase, is my favorite one so far. And he just talks to them on the phone, and it's stupid, and the timing is just classic McDonald, and the editing is weird, and it's the comedy that I need right now to get us all through it. I highly recommend it. The Bob Saget one is it's just okay, but it just Norm MacDonald is always very, very funny, and it's just good, high quality quarantine podcasting. Nick, what have you been consuming?
I watched in the past week, I watched the third and most recent season of Ozark, with Laura Linney and Jason Bateman. And it's a great show. It's, as people might know, it's about a couple from Chicago with a couple kids who leave Chicago under duress and go to the Lake of the Ozarks and start laundering money for a Mexican cartel. They run into issues with a local crime family and a bunch of other stuff. Fantastic. And it's this kind of great moment where I was thinking about it because it's on Netflix, and it's Netflix also ran The Irishman by Martin Scorsese, a couple of years ago, it feels like. And Ozark is a crime drama that is actually relevant to the way we live today. I mean, all of these things are fantasies and whatnot, but it's enmeshed in what life is like in 21st century America. And it's fantastic compared to The Irishman, which is like an elegy for a world that stopped mattering to anybody other than the five people who are still in the mob and Martin Scorsese years ago. Ozark season 3 also has quite possibly the best season ending scene ever. It sets up season 4 so spectacularly. Highly recommend.
I just want to point out that that's like the fourth kick to The Irishman's throat that Nick has done. We actually, and I want a medal for this, we actually finished The Irishman in my household. It only took us 6 months to do it.
What, did you take like shifts? You each watch for 10 minutes and then shift it out?
Yeah.
You should get hazard pay for that, Matt Welch.
Suderman, what have
I
you
have been reading Royal Assassin, the sequel to Assassin's Apprentice, which I mentioned before the apocalypse here on this podcast. It is by Robin Hobb, a 1996. It's the second book in the Farseer trilogy, which is the first of her books set in the kind of Farseer universe. It's a little bit longer than the first one and in some ways a little bit slower paced, especially at the beginning. But it's just such a richly written and considered bit of fantasy writing, one that is really interestingly kind of plays with the same themes and even narrative devices as Game of Thrones and the Game of Thrones books, which were coming out around the same time, in that it is about the challenges of what it means to be a good and moral ruler. It is centered around a bastard who is involved in the royal court. There are no White Walkers, but there are this outsider group called Red Ship Raiders that come in and make the population. They basically turn them into kind of mindless zombies in a kind of White Walker-esque way. And so it's really interesting just to see this other fantasy trilogy or other fantasy series that has dealt with a lot of the same issues, written around the same time. Almost you sort of read it and you feel like, did George R. R. Martin and Robin Hobb like go to the same writing conference somewhere and just sort of talk about these ideas and like what was wrong with modern fantasy, and both go and decide to write series, really complex fantasy epics dealing with the same issues. And it's really quite enjoyable just as a fan of smart, character-driven, plot-driven genre writing. The other thing that I would recommend, though, just for all of the cocktail fans out there, is Naren Young, who is the owner and sort of drink designer behind the bar Dante, which, depending on which bar awards you're looking at, is frequently ranked as one of or even the best bar in the United States. It is currently closed. It's in Manhattan. But it's this great, great bar that has that specializes in sort of Italian aperitif cocktails like the Negroni. And he has been on Instagram showing people how to make cocktails with no tools at home. And so it is the exact opposite of the sort of like you have to own 10,000 bottles and like $500 worth of bar tools and every type of jigger and bar stool, bar spoon and the whole thing. And he's just like, here's how you can make really, really excellent drinks. And he's funny and he wears weird outfits and the drinks are really good. And his taste is just so excellent. He thinks about the making of delicious things so well. And it's just been a treat to learn from somebody who is so obviously an expert in what he's doing.
Catherine, take us home about the silly thing that you've been consuming.
I have, as we have discussed on this podcast before, a great weakness for personality tests of various types. I know they're not real. I know they're not real. However, they're super fun. So the website openpsychometrics.org, don't know what it is, don't know how legitimate it is, offers a bunch of tests, many of which are based on the concept of the Big Five personality test. You can also take your garden variety Myers-Briggs. The one I recommend on there, which we will link not only on the post at reason.com about this podcast, but also on the complete set of all Reason Roundtable recommendations, which you can see at our website at any time. Go check it out. The statistical which character personality quiz, which you answer a few questions and it aligns you with fictional characters from a variety of popular television shows. Your basic West Wing, Game of Thrones, Westworld, Star Trek, Great Gatsby, Harry Potter type cluster. Something there for everyone.
But there's also, we know people who have gotten Sex and the City characters.
That's
too,
true.
Right?
That's
it's
true.
It's not just hour-long serious
right,
dramas.
Right, so I was going to say, so those are some samplings from my top results, which mostly just tells you my personality. I really love this. I would encourage our Reason Roundtable listeners to take this and post your results. Peter Suderman has already posted his. I will share my top results, which are Olenna Tyrell. You may remember her as the incredibly manipulative and sassy Olenna Tyrell, manipulative and sassy old lady who is the ultimate badass of Game of Thrones. Also, Joey Lucas, the pollster from West Wing, Robert Ford, the puppet master from Westworld, and a bit further down, Jadzia Dax, which I'm probably showing my Star Trek ignorance by not fully understanding that character, but I am told it is accurate. Peter, you took it. What were your results?
My top result was Varys from Game of Thrones. And then also in my top 10, I had Elam Garak from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, who is the tailor with a mysterious past who often just kind of not all that surprisingly eventually, but like surprisingly ends up being very useful when you need to like conduct espionage operations and just sort of seems to know a lot about a lot of things. Mycroft Holmes, Doctor Strange, and Peter Gregory from Silicon Valley, who I guess is the character based on Peter Thiel. Was my ended up at number two for me.
Yeah.
So
Peter is the master of spies.
I ended up as Varys. As a Varys, I appreciate that Olenna Tyrell has deigned it useful to keep a Varys around.
I was happy to have come out as Sirius Black from the Harry Potter franchise.
I mean,
it's so
this
good.
Test is real, folks.
It's so good.
This is personality tests
with
are fake,
fits.
But this one is real.
Matt, what did you get?
I'm a very unreliable test taker on these things. It's all like false choices for me. So I answer 50% because you can toggle from 100% to 0% on various like supposed opposites. I'm like, I don't know, in the middle. I think other people who would take it on my behalf might answer differently. Having said that, I am somebody called Iroh on Avatar, The Last Airbender. I have no idea what that means. The only of my top 10 that I even recognize was number two, Arthur Weasley, which doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Yeah.
And then number six, Lucius Fox from The Dark Knight, which also makes zero sense.
By the way,
because Lucius Fox is the gadget guy.
He makes the Batmobile, like, right?
Don't make the Batmobile.
And all
kids.
Of the little bat hooks and everything.
I can't figure out the.
But you know what? There's something there because that was my husband's top result as well, and he is similarly disabled in terms of technology. So it's not about the gadgets.
Matt, you actually had Lester Freeman from The Wire in the number three slot higher than Lucius Fox.
I don't know what that means.
You really are a Lester Freeman of your reasons, Lester Freeman.
Yeah.
There's no question there.
Yeah.
Is he a drug dealer?
He is the really smart cop who has been, who before the major crimes unit that the show is about got started up, had kind of been passed over and people didn't really understand like his wisdom. But in fact, he becomes very useful, and he becomes in some ways sort of, he becomes the like tired of it all and not really willing in some cases to kind of go like all the way because he's so fucking exhausted by the world. But like also like the moral and intellectual center of the investigative unit.
Iroh is a retired general from Avatar, or The Last Airbender. The cartoon show was called Avatar, and it couldn't use that name in the movie because of James Cameron. He's a retired general, Matt, very wise and very powerful. Okay.
Basically, the many people on the Reason staff have now taken this, and I will just say without disclosing without his permission that Robbie Suave's results are lightly terrifying because none of his characters have a moral center at all.
That sounds right.
And that Mike Riggs...
They're all extremely effective schemers.
Yes. And Mike Riggs's results are the polar opposite of Robbie Suave's results. They are all like golden-hearted helpers who make other people be their best selves. So just
is Robbie Draco Malfoy?
Basically, yeah. I don't know if that okay. appeared in his results, but like you are like the Slytherin vibe is strong with Robbie Suave.
I will spoil things a little bit here. I will reveal that one of his top results was Gaius Baltar from Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah,
and that tells you a lot. And also, he was really happy with his results.
Yeah. Tells someone a lot. All right. We will check back with you all, beautiful people. Thank you for listening next Monday. Hopefully, things will start looking up. Who knows? Etc. And stay tuned all throughout the week for Nick's been interviewing people like a madman over on the Reason interview. A lot of incredibly great. Hey, Nick, give us highlights of the last like 10 days of your interviews that people should be checking out.
Well, going back a couple of weeks, I interviewed Richard Epstein, the NYU law professor who has whose predictions on the lower limits of deaths from coronavirus have come a cropper. But I talked to Ron Bailey about epidemiology, Matt Ridley, the rational optimist, who has a great new book coming out called How Innovation Works and Why It Flourishes in Freedom. I talked to Michael Munger, an economist and political scientist at Duke, about kind of long-term implications of the economic shutdown. And we've got a bunch of stuff coming up, which is so hot, Matt, and I love them all so much. You know, when I interview people, it's like Sophie's Choice. I don't want to make a choice. They're all special. Mm-hmm. So please check on Wednesday or go to reason.com/podcast. to subscribe to the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie.
All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll catch you next Monday. Goodbye.